Cestius, breaking camp from Ptolemais, went himself to Caesarea, but sent part of his army ahead to Joppa, with orders that if they could seize the city, they should garrison it. But if the inhabitants got word of their approach in advance, they should wait for him and the rest of the force. Some of them, pressing on by sea and others by land, took the city easily from both sides at once. The inhabitants had no time even to flee, let alone prepare for battle, and the soldiers fell upon them and killed them all, families and all, then plundered the city and burned it. The number of those slain was 8,400. In the same way, he sent a considerable body of cavalry into the district of Narbata, bordering on Caesarea, which laid waste the land, killed a great number of the local people, plundered their property, and burned their villages. Into Galilee, he sent Caecennius Gallus, commander of the 12th Legion, giving him as large a force as he judged sufficient against the nation. The strongest city of Galilee, Sepphoris, received him with expressions of loyalty, and following its prudent example, the other cities remained quiet. But all the rebellious and brigand element fled to the mountain lying at the very center of Galilee, opposite Sepphoris, called a Salmon. Against these Gallus led his forces. As long as they held the high ground, they easily beat off the advancing Romans and killed about 200 of them. But once the Romans worked around and gained the higher positions, they were quickly overcome, for the light-armed men could not stand against heavy infantry at close quarters, nor escape the cavalry in flight, so that only a few slipped away through the rough terrain, while more than 2,000 were killed. Gallus, seeing no further sign of unrest in Galilee, withdrew with his army to Caesarea. Cestius, meanwhile, broke camp with his entire force and marched into Antipatris. Learning that a considerable body of Jews had gathered at a tower called Aphek, he sent men ahead to engage them. But before coming to blows, the Jews scattered in fear, and the Romans, finding the camp abandoned, burned it along with the surrounding villages. From Antipatris, Cestius advanced to Lydda and took the town empty of men, for the whole population had gone up to Jerusalem for the Feast of Tabernacles. He killed 50 of those who did appear, burned the town, and pressed on. Climbing through Bethoron, he pitched camp at a place called Gabau, 50 stadia from Jerusalem. The Jews, seeing the war already drawing close to their mother city, abandoned the feast and rushed to arms. Trusting greatly in their numbers, they charged out to battle in disorder and with shouting, giving no thought even to the rest day, for the Sabbath was the thing they held most sacred. But the fury that shook them free of their piety made them the stronger in the fight as well. They fell on the Romans with such force that they broke through their ranks and cut their way through the middle, killing as they went. Had not the cavalry wheeled round to help the part of the phalanx that was giving way, and the infantry that was not yet exhausted done the same, Cestius would have been in danger of losing his entire force. 515 Romans died, 400 of them infantry and the rest cavalry. Of the Jews, 22 fell. The most valiant of them proved to be the kinsmen of Monobazus, king of Adiabene, Monobazus and Kennedius, and after them Niger the Perean and Silas the Babylonian, who had deserted to the Jews from King Agrippa, in whose service he had been a soldier. Checked in their frontal assault, the Jews withdrew toward the city, but Simon son of Gioras fell on the Romans from behind as they climbed toward Bethoron, tore savagely into their rearguard, and seized many of their baggage animals, which he brought into the city. Cestius remained in his position for 3 days, while the Jews held the high ground, watched the passes, and made it clear they would not rest once the Romans began their march. Seeing this, and recognizing that even Rome's forces were not safe with such a countless enemy multitude holding the mountains all around, Agrippa decided to test the Jews with words, hoping either to persuade the whole body to lay down the war or to detach the dissenters from those who would not agree. He sent, therefore, 2 men well known to them, Borcius and Phoebus, promising on Cestius's behalf a pledge of safety and on Rome's a secure pardon for what had been done if they threw down their weapons and came over. But the insurgents, fearing that the whole populace, hoping for amnesty, would go over to Agrippa, resolved to kill his envoys. Before they could even speak, they killed Phoebus outright. Borcius, though wounded, managed to escape. As for the citizens who protested, they drove them back into the city with stones and clubs. Cestius, seeing this discord among them as his opportunity, brought his whole force to the assault, routed them, and pursued them all the way to Jerusalem. He encamped at the place called Scopus, 7 stadia from the city, and for 3 days made no attempt on it, expecting perhaps that some within would surrender it to him. Meanwhile, he sent many of his soldiers out to plunder grain from the surrounding villages. On the 4th day, which was the 30th of the month Hyperbaratius, he drew up his army and led it into the city. The populace was held under guard by the insurgents, who, terrified by the Roman discipline, gave up the outer districts and withdrew into the inner city and the temple. Cestius entered and set fire to the district called Bezetha, as well as the new city, and the so-called timber market. He then advanced to the upper city and pitched camp opposite the royal palace. Had he chosen at that very hour to force his way inside the walls, he would have taken the city on the spot and ended the war then and there. But the camp prefect Tyrannius Priscus and most of the cavalry commanders, bribed with money by Florus, turned him away from the attempt. Because of this, the war dragged on so long, and the Jews came to be filled with such irreparable disasters. Meanwhile, many of the notable citizens, persuaded by Ananus, son of Jonathan, invited Cestius to enter, promising to open the gates to him. He, whether out of anger or distrust, hesitated and delayed, until the insurgents, becoming aware of the betrayal, threw Ananus's party down from the wall, drove them with stones back into their houses, and themselves stood apart from the towers and hurled missiles at anyone who approached the wall. For 5 days the Romans made every kind of assault and could achieve nothing, but on the next day Cestius took a large number of picked men and his archers and attacked the temple from the north side. The Jews defended it from the portico and repeatedly beat back those who approached the wall, but at last, overwhelmed by the sheer volume of missiles, they gave ground. The leading Romans then set their shields against the wall, and those behind them and the ranks following in turn formed what they call a tortoise, under which the missiles hurtling down slid off harmlessly, and the soldiers, unharmed, began undermining the wall and preparing to set fire to the temple gate. Terrible panic seized the insurgents, and already many were fleeing the city as though it were about to fall at once. The populace took heart at this, and wherever the rebels gave way, they themselves came forward to open the gates and welcome Cestius as a benefactor. Had he pressed the siege a little longer, he would have taken the city immediately. But I think that God, already turned away from them because of the wicked and unwilling to let the temple meet its end that day, held the war back. So Cestius, without grasping either the despair of the besieged or the mood of the populace, suddenly recalled his soldiers, and, giving up hope despite having suffered no defeat, withdrew from the city in the most unaccountable fashion. Emboldened by his unexpected retreat, the rebels rushed out against his rear and destroyed a good number of his cavalry and infantry. That night Cestius camped at the position on Scopus, and the next day, moving further off, only drew the enemy on more, for they pressed against his rear and destroyed them, while others ran along both sides of the road and hurled javelins into his flanks. The men at the rear did not dare turn to face those wounding them from behind, imagining they were pursued by an army beyond counting, and could not bring themselves to check those pressing on their flanks either, being themselves weighed down and afraid of breaking ranks, while they saw the Jews were light and quick in their charges. As a result, they suffered great harm without inflicting any in return. All along the road they were struck down and shaken loose from the column and fell, until many had perished, among them Priscus, commander of the 6th Legion, Longinus the Tribune, and Emilius Jucundus, prefect of a cavalry squadron. They barely reached Gabo, their former camp, having lost much of their baggage. There Cestius remained 2 days, at a loss what to do, but on the 3rd, seeing the enemy grown far more numerous and the whole region around teeming with Jews, he realized that his delay had only worked against him and that staying longer would mean facing still more enemies. To make his flight swifter, he ordered everything that slowed the army's march to be cut loose. So the mules and pack animals were destroyed, all except those carrying missiles and siege engines, which they kept for their usefulness and above all for fear these might fall into Jewish hands, and he led the army on toward Bethoron. The Jews pressed less hard on the open stretches, but once the Romans were funneled into the narrow descent, some blocked their way out ahead while others drove the rearmost down into the ravine, and the whole mass, spread out along the ridge above the road, covered the column with missiles. there even the infantry found it hard to defend themselves. But the danger was still greater for the cavalry, who could neither ride down the road in formation under fire nor charge the enemy up the slope, while on the other side lay cliffs and ravines, into which men, losing their footing, fell to their deaths. There was no place to flee to and no way to fight back. Helpless, they turned to wailing and the cries of the despairing, answered by the war cries of the Jews, at once jubilant and enraged. They would have wiped out Cestius's entire force had not night intervened, in which the Romans took refuge in Bethoron, while the Jews surrounded the whole area and kept watch on every way out. There Cestius, giving up any open route, planned a stealthy escape. He picked out about 400 of his bravest soldiers and stationed them on the rooftops, ordering them to keep calling out the watch signals used in camp, so that the Jews would believe the whole army was still there. He himself, taking the rest, quietly advanced 30 stadia. At dawn, the Jews, seeing the position empty, rushed upon the 400 who had deceived them, quickly cut them down with javelins, and set off after Cestius. But he had already gained a good part of the night's start and fled all the more swiftly by day, so that in their fear and panic, the soldiers abandoned their siege engines, catapults, and most of their other equipment, which the Jews later seized and turned against the very men who had abandoned them. They pursued the Romans as far as Antipatris, and then, since they could not overtake them, turned back, carried off the engines, stripped the dead, gathered up whatever spoil remained, and returned to the mother city singing hymns of victory, having lost only a few of their own, but having killed 5,300 Roman and allied infantry and 480 cavalry. This took place on the 8th of the month Dies, in the 12th year of Nero's reign. After Cestius's disaster, many prominent Jews abandoned the city like men swimming away from a sinking ship. Costobarus and Saul, brothers, together with Philip son of Jasimus, who was the camp commander of King Agrippa, fled the city and went over to Cestius. What became of Antipas, who was besieged with them in the royal palace and disdained flight, only to be killed later by the insurgents, we shall relate. Cestius sent Saul and his companions, at their own request, onto Achaia to Nero, both to explain their situation and to lay the blame for the war on Florus, hoping this would ease the anger directed at himself, along with his own danger. Meanwhile, the people of Damascus, learning of the Roman disaster, resolved to kill the Jews living among them. Since they had long kept them gathered in the gymnasium for this very purpose, out of suspicion, they thought the deed would be easy. But they were afraid of their own wives, who, with few exceptions, had all been drawn to the Jewish religion. For this reason, their great struggle was to keep the matter hidden from them. Falling upon the Jews, who numbered about 10,500, all unarmed, in a confined space, they massacred them within a single hour without fear of resistance. Those who had pursued Cestius, once they returned to Jerusalem, brought over by force those who still favored Rome and by persuasion the rest, and, assembling in the temple, appointed additional generals for the war. Joseph, son of Gorion, and the high priest Ananus were chosen with full authority over affairs in the city, and charged especially with rebuilding its walls. As for Eleazar, son of Simon, although he had in his own possession the Roman spoils, the money seized from Cestius, and much of the public treasury besides, they did not entrust him with any duties, seeing that he was tyrannical by nature, and that the zealots under him behaved like a bodyguard. Yet little by little, through the people's need of the money and Eleazar's own cunning, he worked his way around the populace until they obeyed him in everything. For Idumea they chose other generals, Jesus son of Saphas, one of the chief priests, and Eleazar son of Neus, also a chief priest's son. And to Niger, then governor of Idumea, a man from Perea beyond the Jordan, for which he was called the Perean, they gave orders to submit to these generals. Nor did they neglect the rest of the country. Joseph son of Simon was sent to Jericho, Manasseh to Perea, and John the Essene to command the toparchy of Thamna, to which Lydda, Joppa, and Emmaus were also assigned. Over Gophna and Acrabetta, John son of Ananias was appointed governor, and over both parts of Galilee, Joseph son of Matthias, to whose command was also added Gamala, the strongest city in that region. All the other generals administered what had been entrusted to them, each according to his own energy or judgment. But Joseph, on coming to Galilee, made it his first concern to win the goodwill of the local people, knowing that this above all would bring him success, even if he failed in other respects. Recognizing that he would win over the powerful by letting them share in his authority, and the whole populace by having most matters handled through men of their own region whom they knew, he chose 70 of the oldest and most level-headed men from the nation, and set them up as rulers over the whole of Galilee, and in each city 7 judges for the lesser disputes. For the more serious matters and capital cases, he ordered referred to himself and the 70. Having established these arrangements for order among the cities, he turned to securing them from outside attack. Knowing that the Romans would first invade Galilee, he fortified the most useful positions, Jotapata, Bersabe, and Salamis, as well as Caferco, Jaffa, and Sigoff, and he fortified Mount Idaberion, as it is called, Terici, and Tiberias, and in addition, in the district around Lake Genesaret, the caves in what is called Lower Galilee. In Upper Galilee, he fortified the so-called Rock of Achabara, along with Seph, Iamnith, and Meroth. In the Gaulonitis, he secured Seleucia, Sagana, and Gamala. Only the people of Sepphoris he allowed to build their own wall unaided, since he saw they were wealthy and eager for the war even without being ordered to it. In the same way John, son of Levi, fortified Jeshala on his own initiative, at Josephus's command. In all the other strongholds, Josephus himself was present, laboring alongside the builders and directing the work. He also raised from Galilee a force of more than 100,000 young men, whom he armed entirely with old weapons he had collected and refitted. Then, recognizing that the invincibility of the Roman army rested above all on discipline and constant drill with arms, he gave up hope of achieving the same training, since it was pursued only out of practical need. But he saw that discipline arose from the multiplicity of officers, so in Roman fashion he divided his army and appointed more captains over units. He created ranks among the soldiers, placing them under decurions and centurions, then under tribunes, and above these, commanders of the larger divisions. He taught them the transmission of signals, the trumpet calls for advance and retreat, the assaults of the wings and the wheeling maneuvers, and how they must turn to support a wavering flank from the strength of the rest, and share in the suffering of a hard-pressed unit. Whatever contributed to steadiness of spirit or endurance of body, he explained to them. And above all, he trained them for war by describing to them at every turn the discipline of the Romans, and how they would be fighting against men who, through strength of body and steadiness of spirit, ruled almost the whole inhabited world. He said he would test their obedience in matters of war even before battle was joined, by seeing whether they would abstain from their habitual offenses, theft, banditry, and plunder, and cheating their own countrymen, and regarding harm done to their closest kin as personal gain. For wars are conducted best among those whose whole fighting force has a good conscience, while men corrupt at home treat not only the enemy attacking them, but also God himself as their adversary. Such were the exhortations he continued to give. The force he had ready for battle amounted to 60,000 infantry and 350 cavalry. Besides these, the mercenaries in whom he placed his greatest trust numbered about 4,500, and he kept about him a chosen bodyguard of 600 men. The cities easily supported the rest of the army, apart from the mercenaries. For each of the enlisting towns, sending out half its recruits to serve, kept back the rest to supply provisions for those in the field, so that some were assigned to arms and others to labor, and those who sent the grain received in return protection from the men under arms. While Josephus was administering the affairs of Galilee in this way, a certain scheming man rose up against him from Jeshala, son of Levi, named John the most cunning and deceitful of all men notorious for such wickedness, poor at first, and for a long time kept from wrongdoing only by his lack of means, ready to lie, and skilled at winning belief for his lies, regarding deceit as a virtue and practicing it even against his closest friends, a hypocrite of benevolence and for hope of gain. Utterly murderous, always coveting great things and nourishing his ambitions through petty crimes. He had been a bandit acting alone, and then found companions for his daring, at first few, but ever increasing in number. He took care never to recruit anyone easily overpowered, but chose out those distinguished for soundness of body, steadiness of spirit, and experience in war, until he had gathered a band of as many as 400 men, most of them fugitives from the territory of Tyre and its villages. With these, he plundered the whole of Galilee and kept the great mass of people, already on edge over the coming war, in continual turmoil. By now, aspiring to command and reaching for greater things, he was held back by lack of funds. But when he saw that Josephus took great delight in his energetic activity, he persuaded him first to entrust to him the rebuilding of his native city's wall, a task from which he made large profits from the wealthy. Then, having devised a most cunning scheme, on the pretext that all the Jews throughout Syria were careful to use oil not handled by Gentiles, he requested permission to send it to them at the border. Buying up 4 jars for the price of 1 Tyrian coin, worth 4 Attic drachmas, he sold half a jar at the same price. Since Galilee was especially rich in olive oil, and had at that time produced an abundant crop, by sending large quantities to places in short supply, he alone amassed an immense fortune, which he immediately turned against the very man who had provided him the opportunity for this trade. Supposing that if he brought down Josephus he would himself take command of Galilee, he ordered the bandits under him to press their plundering more vigorously, so that with many disturbances stirred up throughout the country, he might either ambush and kill the general when he came out to suppress them, or, if Josephus overlooked the bandits, might slander him to the local people as complicit. He also spread the rumor far and wide that Josephus was betraying affairs to the Romans, and engineered many such schemes for the man's downfall. At this time, some young men from the village of Dabarida, who were among the guards stationed in the great plain, ambushed Ptolemy, the steward of Agrippa and Bernice, and stripped him of all the baggage he was carrying, which included a great quantity of costly clothing and a large number of silver cups and 600 gold pieces. Unable to dispose of the plunder secretly, they brought it all to Josephus at Terichi. He reproached them for their violence against the royal officials and deposited the goods with Annius, the most powerful man in Terichi, intending to send them back to their owners at the right time, a decision that brought him into the greatest danger. For those who had seized the plunder, resentful at receiving no share of what had been taken, and also having perceived Josephus's intention, that he meant to hand over the fruit of their labor to the royal family, ran through the villages by night and denounced Josephus everywhere as a traitor. They filled the neighboring towns with turmoil as well, so that by dawn 100,000 armed men had rushed together against him. The crowd, gathered in the hippodrome at Terichi, shouted out their fury and demanded to stone him, while others cried out to burn the traitor. John incited the crowd further, and with him a certain Jesus, son of Saphias, then the leader of Tiberias. Josephus's friends and bodyguards, terrified by the fury of the mob, all fled except for 4, but he himself, though already asleep, rose as the fire was being brought near, and though the 4 who remained urged him to flee, they stayed by him. He, undaunted either by his own isolation or by the mass of men standing over him, sprang out before them, tore his clothing, sprinkled dust on his head, twisted his hands behind his back, and fastened his own sword to his neck by its strap. At this, the people close to him, especially the Terichians, were moved to pity, but those from the countryside and the neighboring towns, to whom he seemed to be putting on a show, reviled him and demanded that he produce the public funds at once and confess to his treasonous compact. For from his posture, they had already assumed he would deny nothing they suspected, but had done all this display of grief only to win pardon. But for him, this show of humility was a preparation for a stratagem, and by his art he set those angry with him at odds with one another over the very charges they had leveled. Then, when given leave to speak, he said, "I never intended either to send this money back to Agrippa or to keep it for my own profit. May I never consider one of you an enemy, or gain that harms the common good, a friend to me. But seeing, men of Terichi, that your city especially needed security and required money to build a wall, and fearing the people of Tiberias and the other towns, who had their eyes on the plunder, I chose to hold the money quietly, so that I might build you a wall with it. If this does not please you, I will produce what was brought here and let you plunder it. But if my plan for you was a good one, then punish your own benefactor." At this the Terichians applauded him, but those from Tiberias, along with the others, reviled and threatened him, and each group, abandoning Josephus, fell to quarreling with each other. He, now trusting in those who had become attached to him, the Terrakians numbered about 40,000, addressed the whole crowd rather more boldly. After reproaching them at length for their rashness, he said he would fortify Terrace from the funds now at hand, and would likewise secure the other cities as well. For money would not be lacking, if they were of one mind about whom they should be raising it from, and were not provoked against the man raising it. At this, the rest of the deceived crowd withdrew, still angry, but 2,000 rushed at him under arms, and, since he had already reached his lodging, stood before it uttering threats. Josephus now resorted to a second deception. Going up onto the roof and quieting their uproar with a gesture of his hand, he said he did not know what they were demanding, since he could not make it out amid the confusion of their shouting. But he would do whatever they ordered, if they would send in a few representatives to confer with him quietly. Hearing this, the notables, along with their leaders, went in. He dragged them into the innermost part of the house, locked the outer door, and had them flogged until their entrails were laid bare, while the crowd outside waited, supposing that those who had gone in were pleading their case at length. Then, suddenly throwing open the doors, he sent the men out covered in blood, striking such terror into those who had been making threats that they threw down their weapons and fled. At this, John's envy grew still sharper, and he prepared a second plot against Josephus. Feigning illness, he begged by letter that Josephus permit him to make use of the hot springs at Tiberias for his health. Josephus, not yet suspecting the plotter, wrote to the officials in the city to provide John with lodging and provisions. Having enjoyed these for 2 days, he then set about the business for which he had really come, and by winning some over with deceit and others with bribes, he tried to persuade them to abandon Josephus. When Silas, whom Josephus had put in charge of guarding the city, learned of this, he wrote to him at once about the plot. Josephus, on receiving the letter, traveled through the night at speed and arrived at Tiberias by dawn. The rest of the people came out to meet him, but John, though he suspected that Josephus's arrival was directed against him, nonetheless sent one of the notables to him and pretended to be sick, saying that being bedridden had prevented him from coming for his treatment. But when Josephus had gathered the Tiberians in the stadium and was trying to address them about the matters in his letters, John sent in armed men secretly and ordered them to kill him. The crowd, seeing these men bearing their swords, cried out, and Josephus, turning at the outcry and seeing the blade already at his throat, leapt down to the shore. He had been standing on a mound about 6 cubits high while addressing the people, and as a boat happened to be nearby, he jumped aboard it with 2 bodyguards and fled out into the middle of the lake. His soldiers, quickly seizing their weapons, advanced against the plotters. There, fearing that if civil war broke out he would destroy the city for the grudge of a few men, Josephus sent word to his own men to look only to their own safety, and neither to kill anyone nor to expose those responsible. They obeyed the order and kept quiet, but those in the surrounding countryside, on learning of the plot and the man who had contrived it, gathered against John. But he had already fled to his native Gischala ahead of them. The Galileans streamed in to Josephus from the towns, and gathering in many tens of thousands under arms, cried out that they were present to move against John, the common enemy, and that they would burn down even the native city that had sheltered him along with him. Josephus, for his part, said he welcomed their goodwill, but restrained their impulse, preferring to subdue his enemies by cunning rather than to kill them. Taking down by name those from each city who had joined John's revolt, for the townspeople eagerly pointed out their own, and threatening through heralds that within 5 days he would plunder the property and burn the houses, together with the families, of all who had not abandoned John, he detached 3,000 at once, who came and threw down their weapons at his feet. And with those who remained about 2,000 fugitive Syrians, John turned again from open schemes to secret plots. He sent messengers secretly to Jerusalem, slandering Josephus for the size of his forces and declaring that he would soon come as tyrant of the capital unless he were forestalled. The people, having anticipated this, paid no attention, but the powerful men, out of envy, and some of the magistrates too, secretly sent John money to gather mercenaries so that he might make war on Josephus, and among themselves they also voted to recall him from his command. They did not, however, think the decree alone would suffice. They sent 2,500 armed men and 4 distinguished men, Jazar son of Namachus, Ananias son of Sadduki, Simon and Judas son of Jonathan, all reputed to be most capable speakers, so that these might turn the people's goodwill away from Josephus. If he came willingly, they were to let him give an account of himself, but if he tried by force to remain, they were to treat him as an enemy. His friends had already sent word to Josephus that an army was coming, but they did not disclose the reason, since his enemies had planned it in secret. For that reason, since he had taken no precautions, 4 cities at once went over to those who had come against him, Sepphoris, Gabara, Jeshala, and Tiberias. But he quickly won these back too, without recourse to arms, and having overcome the 4 commanders by stratagems, sent the most powerful of their soldiers up to Jerusalem. At this the people were greatly incensed and rushed, together with these men, to kill those who had sent them, had they not escaped by fleeing in time. As for John, from then on the fear he felt of Josephus kept him confined within the walls of Jeshala. A few days later Tiberias revolted again, its people having invited King Agrippa in, and when he failed to arrive by the appointed day, but a few Roman cavalrymen happened to appear that same day, Josephus' news of the revolt reached Tarichaea at once. But Josephus had sent out all his soldiers to gather grain, and so he could bring himself neither to march out alone against the rebels nor to stay where he was, fearing that if he delayed, the king's men would get into the city first. For the following day, with the Sabbath beginning, would give him no chance to act. He therefore resolved to outmaneuver the rebels by a trick. He ordered the gates of Tarichaea closed, so that no one could carry word of his plan to the men he meant to move against, and had every boat on the lake gathered together. 330 were found, with no more than 4 sailors in each, and rowed with all speed toward Tiberias. He kept far enough from the city that it was not easy to tell the boats were empty, and had them ride at anchor riding high on the water, while he himself, taking only 7 of his bodyguard and no weapons, went in closer to be seen. His opponents, watching from the walls and still hurling abuse at him, were seized with panic. Supposing every boat crammed with soldiers, they threw down their arms and, waving branches of supplication, begged him to spare the city. Josephus, heaping threats and reproaches on them, said that first they had taken up the war against Rome, then squandered their strength on civil strife, doing exactly what their enemies most wished, and now they were in haste to destroy the very man responsible for their safety, and felt no shame in shutting the city against the one who had built its walls. Yet he would nonetheless receive those who came to plead their case and offer pledges to secure the city. At once 10 of the most powerful men of Tiberias came down to him. These he took aboard one of the boats and had it rowed further out. Then he ordered 50 more of the council, the best known among them, to come forward, as though he wanted some pledge of good faith from them as well. Then, contriving ever newer pretexts, he called out one group after another as if for the terms of an agreement, and instructed the boat captains, as each boat filled, to sail quickly for Tarichaea and shut the men up in prison, until he had seized the whole council, 600 strong, and about 2,000 of the common people, and carried them all off by boat to Tarichaea. The rest cried out that a certain Clitus bore the chief blame for the revolt, and urged him to vent his anger on that man alone. Josephus had resolved to kill no one, but ordered Levi, one of his own guards, to go out and cut off Clitus's hands. Clitus, afraid to go out alone into a crowd of enemies, refused. Then, seeing Josephus fuming aboard the boat and ready to leap out and carry out the punishment himself, Clitus begged from the shore to be allowed to keep one hand. Josephus agreed, on condition that Clitus cut off the other himself, and Clitus drew his sword with his right hand and cut off his left. To such terror had Josephus reduced him. Thus, with empty boats and 7 guards, Josephus took the populace captive and brought Tiberias back under his control. A few days later, finding that Sepphoris had joined in the revolt along with them, he allowed his soldiers to plunder it. But he then gathered up everything taken and gave it back to the townspeople, and did the same for the people of Sepphoris, for having subdued them too, he wanted the plundering to serve as a lesson, and then won them back to goodwill by restoring their property. So the disturbances in Galilee came to an end, and once the factions had ceased their internal turmoil, they turned to preparations against Rome. In Jerusalem, meanwhile, Ananus the high priest and all the powerful men who were not pro-Roman were repairing the wall and building great numbers of siege engines. Throughout the whole city, weapons and armor were being forged. The mass of young men was drilling without order or discipline, and everything was full of turmoil. The moderate citizens fell into deep despondency, and many, foreseeing the disasters to come, wept aloud. Prophetic utterances, unwelcome to those who loved peace, were extemporized to please those who had kindled the war instead. And the condition of the city, even before the Romans arrived, was already like a city doomed to perish. Ananus, for his part, was concerned to draw the city back gradually from its preparations for war, and to turn the rebels and the folly of the men called zealots toward what was truly advantageous. But he was overpowered by their violence, and what end he met we shall show later. In the toparchy of Akrabatene, Simon son of Gioras gathered a large following of revolutionaries and turned to plunder, ravaging not only the houses of the rich but torturing their owners as well. And it was already plain, even at this distance, that he was setting himself up as a tyrant. When an army was sent against him by Ananus and the other leaders, he fled with his men to the bandits at Masada and stayed there, plundering Idumea all the while, until the deaths of Ananus and his other enemies. As a result, the leaders of the nation, because of the great number of the murdered and the ceaseless raids, gathered an army and kept the villages under garrison. Such, then, was the state of affairs in Idumea.